Okay, so thanks for the opportunity to talk about these things here. What I will be telling you is effects of disorder on quantum phase transitions, and I want to put particular emphasis on rare disorder fluctuations. And what I will show you in the end is that in contrast to classical systems, where these rare disorder fluctuations only have a very small effect, they can have the very dramatic effects in quantum systems. For instance, they can lead to a smear type of a phase transition where the order is very inhomogeneous in space. So you can get static structures from rare disorder fluctuations in the vicinity of a quantum phase transition. Okay, and let me jump right into it. To get you familiar with the concepts, let's imagine a very simple magnetic system, an Ising model or a Heisenberg model. And let's assume that we have some spatial variation of the coupling strengths. So we have strong bonds and weak bonds, for instance. And I want to restrict myself to the simplest possible type of disorder where there is no frustration. So all the bonds have the same sign, so there is no competing type of order, no frustration. The only effect of the disorder is that it locally changes the tendency towards order. And I will mostly use a magnetic language in this talk, but the concepts are much more general than magnetism. Okay, and there's a few questions, some of them very old, some of them not so old, which you can ask in such a situation. And of course, the most obvious one is will there still be a sharp phase transition? And for classical systems, this has been answered long ago in the affirmative. But I will show you that's not so clear in the quantum case in general. And then, of course, if you still do have a phase transition, then you can ask what happens to the critical behavior. And as you will see, it will also be very useful to look not just at the critical point, but also in the vicinity of the critical point. So the common law on how to approach this question is the Harris criterion, which is by now more than 30 years old. And what you do there is you essentially ask what happens to the average disorder strength as you increase the length scale. And as I suppose most of you know, this leads to the famous criterion for the correlation length exponent. So if the correlation length exponent nu is large enough, d here is a spatial dimension, then introducing weak disorder of the type I just explained will not change the critical behavior at all. Or at least the clean picture is internally stable against disorder. And what that means is that if you look at large enough length scales, the disorder gets averaged out, and all the macroscopic observables, they are self-averaging. And there's one specific example which one can give for this scenario, which is a 3D classical Heisenberg magnet, where nu is roughly 0.7. And as you see, this fulfills this inequality, and so your disorder does not change the critical behavior. So that's a boring case. Now let's ask what happens if this criterion is violated. This is also, for the classical case, well investigated. And the general framework for classical systems is that then the old clean fixed point becomes unstable, and the critical behavior changes. You get a different critical point with new exponents, which then fulfill this inequality. And at such a fixed point, the inhomogeneities, they do not average out anymore. They remain finite at all length scales, which also means that the macroscopic observables are not self-averaging. That's in itself an interesting, somewhat counterintuitive result. And the probably simplest example for this scenario is a 3D classical Ising magnet. Now, before we had a Heisenberg magnet, now we have an Ising magnet. And you see here the clean nu is a little less now. And it's particular, it's less than 2/3. And therefore, the Harris criterion is violated. And so something new must happen. And from numerical simulations, we know that we get a new critical point, which has a nu, which now fulfills the Harris criterion. what's shown here is a proof, a numerical proof of this non-self-averaging of observables. This shows the distribution of the susceptibility for different system sizes. So what you would expect, of course, if self-averaging was true, is if you go to larger and larger systems, this distribution sharpens up until you get, in the thermodynamic limit, just one value, the average value, right? But you see here that it does not happen. This shows the width of the distribution as a function of system size. And you see it's roughly constant. And you not just the width, but the entire distribution is essentially unchanged if you normalize it properly with the average value. So this shows four or five different distributions plotted on top of each other for system sizes ranging from about 4 to 80. So clearly, this distribution does not sharpen up, and it retains a finite width even at in the thermodynamic limit. And so observables are not self-averaging. Yes, in this case, in this numerical case here, I think what they used was a binary distribution for the JIJs with two positive values, so no frustration. Okay, so that's a classical case. Now let's look at the quantum phase transition, so a zero-temperature phase transition. And the crucial point is that, as you all know, at a quantum phase transition, imaginary time becomes important, becomes an important dimension. However, the impurities, of course, are time-independent. It's quenched disorder. And so therefore, you see here, if this is the imaginary time direction and this is space, right, then the disorder is perfectly correlated in this new important extra dimension, the imaginary time dimension. So effectively, what we are dealing now with is a problem with correlated disorder. And it's, I think, intuitively clear, without doing a calculation, that these correlations have to increase the effect of the disorder, because it's much harder to average something like this out than to average out a local fluctuation. So therefore, the generic expectation is that disorder effects at a quantum phase transition will be stronger than at a classical phase transition. And indeed, this turns out to be true, at least in many examples, and the most famous one is probably the random quantum Ising model. We have an Ising chain, conventional Ising model in one dimension, and you have a transverse magnetic field which induces quantum fluctuations, spins between up and down. And though in the clean case, this has a quantum phase transition at a certain critical field. But we now ask what happens if you make the JIJs or the transverse fields or both of them random. And this problem, interestingly, has an exact or asymptotically exact solution, which was found by Daniel Fisher in the mid-90s. And for our general discussion, the interesting thing is that this presents a qualitatively new scenario. What happens under renormalization here is that the disorder increases without limit if you increase the length scale. So that's the third possibility, right? You have, the first case was the Harris criterion is fulfilled, then the disorder vanishes at large length scales. Then we had these classical dirty fixed points, Grinstein-type fixed points, that the disorder stays constant. I showed you numerical results showing that. And here we have now a situation where the disorder actually increases this increasing length scale. It's very counterintuitive. So you zoom out, and the length scale becomes more and more rough.
One might think that if I have to replace D by D plus Z,
yeah.
That's wrong, because if it's static disorder, it's correlated in tau. And therefore, you can't just replace something that is random in space. You can't treat time and space as similar variables in quantum phase transition, because the disorder is correlated.
The symmetry is broken, yes, and therefore more interesting. So that's one way to look at it, and therefore more interesting stuff happens than just an extension of the dimensionality.
Can I ask you, yeah. Two other variables.
Yeah. In these classical Grinstein-type fixed points I was talking before, the relative strength of the disorder settles at a finite value, right? And in the observables, this is represented in the finite width which you get for the normalized susceptibility, for instance. In this case, as you will see in a second, the bit increases with increasing system size.
So, would you also run into the population limit or population transition action?
No, this is still a true quantum. It's a true quantum phase transition. This is not percolation. Okay, and here is again numerical results which show how the width of the distribution actually increases the system size. So that's work by Peter Young and Daniel Fisher. And what's shown here is the end-to-end correlation in a chain, right? So they look at the finite chain length and they calculate the end-to-end correlation. And that's a distribution function of that object for different lengths of the chains. And first I want to point your attention on the scale. That's a logarithmic scale, and it ranges from 0 to 30. So that's a huge width, right? It's extremely broad, this distribution. And furthermore, you see with increasing system size, it becomes rapidly even more broad. So here actually the width of the disorder, here as reflected in the width of the distribution of this observable, diverges in the limit of infinite system size. And it turns out one can scale this, and that's an exponential form for this divergence, which I don't want to talk about in detail now. Okay, so what I've done so far is essentially I've been talking about the average behavior of the disorder. So I've told you there are three cases. The disorder can stay either, it can go down to zero, the disorder can go to, it can stay constant, or the typical bits of the disorder distribution can diverge under renormalization. What I want to focus your attention now is that in quantum systems, there is very interesting and very strong effects which are not produced by the average, by the typical disorder, but by rare disorder fluctuations. You may say the tails of the disorder distribution. And let's first go back to the classical case. Now this phenomenon has been investigated for a long time. So let's look at the classical magnet again. And let's assume we dilute it by removing spins, right? Now it's clear that this dilution will reduce the overall tendency towards magnetism. That's because I remove spins, right? And then I remove neighbors. However, there can be a large region that due to a statistical fluctuation there are no impurities. And the probability for finding such a region is of course exponentially small in the volume. However, it's clear that if I'm below the clean bulk critical temperature, but still above the lower ordering temperature for the dirty system, then these regions here will have a tendency towards local order. Because they look like pieces of the clean system, right? And now the question is, can these rare regions actually make a significant contribution to the physics, to the thermodynamics, let's say? It's clear that the dynamics must be very slow, because in this region here, where they are locally ordered, you can only turn them over as a whole, right? Because they are locally phase coherent. Okay, and for the classical case, this problem has been first studied by Griffiths. And one way to look at it is that you say, well, let's estimate what can be the contribution of these regions here to the susceptibility. And so we have to integrate over all possible sizes of these regions. And we have the probability of finding such a region. And then, of course, you have to write something down for the contribution which each region can make. And in the classical system, of course, it can at best grow as a power law. It's known it can never grow faster than the volume. And close to the clean critical point, you can actually use finite size scaling to determine the power. Crucial point for my argument is you play an exponential against the power law, and so it's clear this integral will be very weak, right? Because the exponential rarity will always win. And therefore, these classical Griffiths effects, even though they are there, and lead to a singularity in the free energy everywhere in this region, they are very, very weak. And to the best of my knowledge, they have never been observed in an experiment.
It's actually, I know of explicit examples where it's been observed, but this is electronic systems. It's a purely dope superconductor.
still in the vicinity of a classical transition, or?
Well, then there it's a different story. There it's basically temperature zero, but looking at the functional planar issue.
Yeah. I will show you in a second that the zero temperature transition, the effect will be stronger. Okay. Now, let's look at a quantum phase transition again, a zero temperature. And again, we have now to take into account the imaginary time direction. And since the disorder is time independent, it's perfectly correlated in this direction. And that for our rare regions, that means if there's a rare disorder fluctuation, meaning no impurities at some point in time, then we stay there for all times. So effectively, therefore, your rare region is much bigger, right? Because it's finite in the space directions, but it's infinite in the imaginary time directions.
Excuse me, just a very stupid question.
Yeah.
If you would take the percolation cluster in two dimensions, put the quantum magnet on it,
yeah,
would that be ordered?
That depends on the strength of the fluctuations. But if the fluctuations are weak enough, it can be potentially ordered. In contrast to the classical case, as you know, where it's only ordered at zero temperature. So yes, if the fluctuations are weak enough, then it can be ordered. So
the system on the percolation cluster with the water.
Yes, yeah.
At zero temperature.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so therefore, the expectation is that these Griffith singularities, these rare region effects, are enhanced. Because effectively, the regions are now much bigger, right? They are infinite in one of the relevant directions. Okay, and indeed, you can work that out for this random quantumizing model, which I showed you before. And so let's do the same estimate. Now, we again try to estimate the contribution of the rare regions to the thermodynamics. And so we have to sum over all possible rare regions, and we have the probability of a rare region. But now, we have the contribution which a single rare region can make to the thermodynamics. And so what we have here is now the contribution to the susceptibility of such an extended object. So if you think in terms of the classical picture where this is an extra dimension, you have the susceptibility of a one-dimensional Ising model with a rod-like geometry. So it's has a finite extension in this direction, but it's infinite in this direction. And as you probably know, and is well known, the susceptibility for such a thing diverges much more strongly as a function of the size here than the susceptibility of a finite object. So you get an exponential divergence. And now you see something new can happen, right? Because now you play the exponential rarity of these regions against an exponentially large contribution which a big rare region can make.
Sorry, I don't know. Can you amplify this? Why it goes exponential with the volume size of this?
Yeah. Okay. One way to see it, which I find the simplest one, is to realize, of course, that you can always think about this as a classical dimension. And now the rare region here in our system is effectively one infinite in this direction, but it's finite in this direction. So it is an Ising model, for instance, one dimension, infinite. And of course, this here, this dimension, can be interpreted as a local coupling strength, right? So or the local size of the spin, right? And now you have to remember the susceptibility of a one-dimensional Ising model diverges exponentially with the coupling strength at low temperatures, right? And that's what's written here. Okay, so now you play two exponentials against each other, and it's clear that something interesting can happen. And if you work it out, then you see that you get a power law density of states for these low-energy excitations, right? Just insert the two into each other, and you get a power law. There's a non-universal power, which depends on these prefactors here. And therefore, you get, and I will come to that in a second. Yeah. And therefore, you get a power law singularity in the susceptibility, even so we are not at the critical point. So we get a power law singularity in the susceptibility in this entire region between the clean and dirty critical points where these things can show local order. So we get much more, much stronger Griffith effects, and actually these have been claimed to be seen in experiments in heavy fermion materials, also the evidence is somewhat shaky, but it's clear that at least potentially they are visible because we now have two poles, right, two singularities.
In the pure magnetic system?
Pardon?
Has anybody seen any of these power law contributions in the magnetic system?
Yes, but people claim they see them in the vicinity of the anti-ferromagnetic transition in certain heavy fermions.
Those fermions are insulated, magnetic insulated.
I'm not aware of it. If Z prime is you get from a combination of A and Z. If you do the calculation, which is essentially four lines, which I can, if you're interested, can show you, then you see that this combination here, D over Z prime, is essentially A over Z or Z over A. I mean. And since of course these are continuously varying parameters in this Griffith region, this is a continuously varying exponent. And the reason it's written in this form is mostly historically. Okay, so now let's go one step further. So far I've shown you that these rare regions in quantum systems have much stronger effects, and they actually can lead to power law singularities. Now I will go one step further and show you that they can have even stronger effects in systems with itinerant electrons around, with overdamped dynamics. So now let's look at an itinerant magnet. And just for to be specific, I want to look at an itinerantizing quantum antiferromagnet. So a metallic quantum magnet. And of course, as you know, in the clean system, the Gaussian propagator looks like this. And the crucial point is that now we have overdamped dynamics. Instead of having omega squared, which would be for localized spins, we now have a mod omega, which is of course produced by the coupling to the conduction electrons. If we Fourier transform this into imaginary time, we get a 1 over tau squared. So we have a effective long-range interaction along this direction. Now the crucial point is the following. We can still have the same structure of the rare regions, of course, right? So they are infinite in this direction, and finite in the space-like directions, but now we have a long-range interaction in this direction. So effectively, our rare regions are now equivalent to a one-dimensional Ising chain with a long-range interaction, not a short-range one. And it's well known that an Ising chain with a 1 over r squared interaction can have an ordered phase, in contrast to the 1D model with short-range interaction. What that means for our problem is that a rare region can undergo the phase transition independently from the bulk system. Right? As long as the itinerant electrons are around to provide the damping, then a rare region can actually develop static order without order in the bulk system. And a more quantum mechanical point of view for this is that you can calculate the tunneling rate for such an island embedded in the sea of conduction electrons, right? And then you find that for sufficiently large islands, the tunneling rate exactly vanishes. And this has been done a couple of years ago by Georg Schmalian and collaborators. Okay, so what that means is we now get a very different scenario, right? These rare regions, they do not fluctuate at all, right? And in the beginning, I told you they have very slow dynamics because you can turn them over only as a whole. But now we see that in this case, they don't turn over at all, right? At least the sufficiently big ones. They become static. So you develop a static order parameter, magnetization in my example, in part of the system. And separate parts of the system will do that at different values of the coupling constant. And what it means, of course, is that you don't get the sharp transition anymore because there's no collective effect in space. Almost finished. So one could say the quantum phase transition in this case is not sharp anymore, but it's smeared because different parts of your system, the different regions in space, develop order independently.
Question. Yeah. When the first region does it, mean yeah. this function of controller parameter,
yeah.
in this should generate a mean field which acts on all the others, and then could there be the possibility to restore a transition? When you consider coupling of these islands, which you have not so far?
Yeah, this is of course true. And if you consider the coupling between the islands, which will be extremely weak, right? Because the islands are rare by definition, and they are only coupled by the bulk correlation length, which is finite in the region where we are, then you can develop a total order parameter. But this will be destroyed by extremely low temperatures, and I will show you two figures in a second. This will be the last things I do. And above this, these islands will be independent classical objects.
Yeah, but suppose we ask for the true zero temperature behavior, which is not relevant for any experiment.
Yeah. Then the interactions between the islands can trigger order, and it's not really a priori clear of what type this order would be in a real system. In the simple models I'm talking about, it would be of the same type as the bulk order, right? Because there's only one type of interaction around. In a real system, of course, you have to think about RKTY and all types of things, and so there may be more complicated order between these islands.
Just to follow up.
Yeah.
Trigger the order or must trigger the order?
Is there, must there be a phase transition? Well, yes. In these class of models, I consider there will always be a finite, a non-zero value of the total order parameter as soon as you develop order on the first island, so which essentially means if you cross the clean critical point. But I would still claim that this is, you should not call this a phase transition because there's no collective effect, there's no finite correlation, no infinite correlation length in space. It's a purely local phenomenon. The correlation length in space never diverges. Okay, and let me just show you two pictures. So what you should expect, and this is now a sketchy phase diagram, where you here have temperature. Here you have whatever your control parameter is, let's say this order. So here you are deep in the magnetic phase and everything looks conventional, but then out here you develop an exponential tail, and that's exactly what you have been talking about, towards the clean critical point. And in these simple models, this tail would stretch all the way to the clean system, right? To zero. To essentially 0% of magnetic atoms. But you also see from here that at least for this class of models, this tail is extremely weak, where you actually get order between the islands. So it's a double log here, right? So it's double exponential in the distance from the clean critical point here. So it's an extremely low temperature above which the coherence between the islands is destroyed, and the islands only remain as independent, essentially static classical objects. Let me show you one more picture from a simulation. So this is a simulation, and here you see essentially how the local magnetization looks in the tail of this smear transition. So you have large regions where there's nothing, and in between you have islands where the order parameter is essentially of the same order of magnitude as it would be in the clean system. Okay, and since I'm running out of time, let me just show the conclusions. Thank you.
In that plot that you show the magnetization of the...
In this sketch.
That one, the simulation. Why the magnetization is always has the same sign there?
Because in the simulation, of course, I have the residual coupling between the islands in there. That's a real simulation, right? And so therefore, the islands will actually align.
and you will not have some island so isolated that we'd be pointing the other way.
No, because there's a finite, there's a very small but non-zero coupling between the islands, and since they are essentially classical objects, they will align in the same way, at least for the simple minor class of models.
So this is why you always have a critical temperature for all values of x between 0 and 1.
Yeah, that's true, yes.
That would make it common. It's not going to be very short, so I don't know.
How short is it?
Under 5 minutes.
You have 2.5.
So there is a place where the Mishnah scales come in a major way, and the curious outcome of the consideration of the addition of the Mishnah scales was that it basically allowed to correct the misprint or common misword. Recycled misconception about the fair diagnosis, very superconductive. And so the story is that actually, if you look at the cortical theory, or that's what superconductive is in this case, then you know the story that actually the density phase creeps down and hits zero, there's a little region where there's a gap of superconductivity there. And in the end, you can look at the low energy density of states and see that these clusters, in other words, no matter how small the concentration of impurities is, there are always rare regions where the local concentration exceeds the critical one and essentially provide the other regions. So these tails actually extend down to zero. So it's almost like your plot of T versus X.
Yeah.
The density of states remains, albeit exponentially small, but finite at lower energies. And as a result of that, actually, the phase diagram, you know, remember they say T versus temperature versus the critical temperature versus entropy. There's a little sliver of gap of superconductivity. So,
And if you look at the literature back in the 60s, actually, when they tried to fit the theory to experiments, in disorder, very sort of simple actual superconductors. But it works very nicely here. And it fits the theory experiment. But always consistently misses it. And it fits very nicely the gap threshold. But then it dies over here. And the data always show the finite conductance in the material. So the essentially the data you look at in 60, about 65, and I can give you references. It's just looking at you, begging for explanation, and people just choose to sort of see this way here.
But you can't compare with experiments because there are no material experiments.
What you can compare with is the drawback of the I would call the Gorkov theory is one parameter here. Basically, the same rate, this disorder rate, scattering rate, controls both C suppression and the density of states. And what we are arguing is that Lipschitz scales basically effectively decouple them. The density of states is the most direct function of this. So what you can show is a serious, I would say, troublesome departure from it because of Gorkov theory. Don't get me wrong, this is a very important theory, category of power. It predicted gap of superconductance, but there are important statistical corrections along the line what we just heard. So I just want to point out that textbook, when people show, it gets recycled from textbook to textbook about how exactly the gap of fusion would be in natural superconductance. It's not true. And it has not been true from the beginning if you look at the data.
And when you compare this scenario with experiments, I mean, of course you get some state in the gap.
Yeah.
There's something harder one.
Yeah, actually you can look at the trend. So the same, so the planar junctions where you look at the metal, the magnetic field, the superconductor, the tunnel,
and what you see two things. One, the density space evolution here, of course, it gets broader, right? It gets broader. So the real big density space, the personal gap threshold moves down, and the tail grows. And of course, the work that you keep seeing here, but still consistently making it here. So what is clear is that there is growth of the residual density space of lower standards measured as a function of concentration well below critical one.
Says memory could not be read.
Oh.
Is that a disaster? May be a disaster. Can I borrow somebody else's computer? I have it on a stick. What? Switch off?
We'll do that,
we don't have any ready here. Okay, the next speaker in order was Tamara Nooner, so if you're ready, you could go and just cross. I think we need to just do a hard reboot there. Okay.
You need this?
Okay, so I want to talk about the role of out-of-plane effects with respect to the formation of nanoscale inhomogeneity in cooperate superconductors. And this is a project I've been working on together with Brian Anderson, Ashut Melikian, and Peter Hirschweiss at the University of Florida. And okay, so obviously this refers quite a lot to David's experiments, and since we heard so many beautiful talks, I will not repeat all the experimental results, but I just sort of want to briefly remind you or summarize what we think are like the most important features about this experiment a theory should be able to capture. Well, they're sort of summarized in the figure. If one compares the DIDD curves are compared over different patches of the sample, it looks like the spectra in each patch are the spectral line shape is determined by the local gap value. That means in regions with like small gap regions, one finds large coherence peaks, and in regions with large gap values, the coherence peaks are strongly suppressed. So this is one of the main features. Another main, very important features are that at low energies, although the gap, the coherence peak are very inhomogeneous, at low energies, the spectra look very homogeneous throughout the whole sample, and the spectra are quite particle hole symmetric. If the the IDV curves are integrated up to large biases, it looks like the charge modulations are only very small, the overall charge modulations across the sample. And also, it has been recently impossible in Davis experiments to identify some impurity states, and if one believes that these are the locations that they indicate the location of the oxygen dopant atoms, then one would find that the gap magnitude and the oxygen locations are positively correlated. Okay, what could be the origin of these inhomogeneities? Early on it has been suggested that the inhomogeneities, formation of the inhomogeneities is related to the position of the dopant atoms, and it was suggested that the dopant atoms, because they give away two holes, they act as potential scatterers. And it was suggested that close to the dopant atoms, the hole concentration is enhanced, and that then the gap magnitude will simply follow sort of on the length scale of the coherence length, this local doping variation, and this way give rise to the inhomogeneities observed experimentally. On the other hand, it has also been suggested that especially in the underdoped system, that these inhomogeneities could sort of reflect competing order parameters, like for example, interferomagnetism, as we will hear later. So in this talk, I will focus on the optimal doping. That means I will neglect competing order parameters, which are maybe not so important in the optimally doped sample. At first, I will spend some time reconsidering this first proposal, so reconsider a model which is based on the fact that these dopant atoms act mainly as potential scatterers, and I will try to indicate the problem one runs into if one sticks to this model. And then I will instead propose that one can actually capture a lot of experimental features if one assumes that the main scattering process is not scattering at potential scatterers, but rather at order parameter variations, which could be, for example, introduced via dopant-modulated pair interaction. Okay, so concretely, we consider the standard DCS, D-wave DCS mean field Hamiltonian with a band structure which has a tight binding band structure with a nearest and next nearest neighbor Hopping matrix element and a nearest neighbor pairing term. In the part of the talk where I will focus on the potential scattering model, we simply model the dopant atoms, which are, we assume, a distance set away from the copper oxygen plane by some Yukawa potential. And for optimally doped samples, because each oxygen gives away two holes, we consider a concentration of 7.5 oxygen dopant atoms. In the second part of the talk, where I want to discuss the effect of the order parameter modulations themselves, so these are most easily introduced by assuming that the dopant atoms locally modulate or increase the pair interaction. And so for simplicity, we again assume that the pair interaction due to each dopant is basically given by a Yukawa type form. And because the pair interactions are bond variables, we simply take the average of the two adjacent sides. Okay, so how do we treat this model? We will basically just discuss two types of results. So on the one hand, we solve and set consistently the resulting Boogaloo-Virchow equations on a lattice containing 2 times 80 times 80 sites. And on the other hand, I will discuss some single impute. No, 2 means because we have a rotated lattice. So we simply rotated the square lattice by 45 degrees, and then it's, we have always one in the center, so that's why it's 2 times 80 times 80. But it's still the normal square lattice. Okay, so since we rotated the lattice by 45 degrees, so it looks basically like this. So on this dimension, this 80 times 80, but because we rotated the lattice by 45 degrees, it's like... Yeah, but this is just, this we just sort of, that's nothing important. It's just because in experiments, the figures are rotated with 45 degrees, so we sort of did the same. So that's... So the square lattice sort of that. Yeah. So it's nothing important. That's just a little bit. Yeah.
So it's not like
two layers. No. This really doesn't mean anything. That's just the number of sites we had in the system. okay, on the other hand, I will also simply discuss some single impurity results, which we simply obtain by solving the G matrix, which simply corresponds, as usual, summation of multiple scattering processes, where in the potential scattering case, the potential enters in the tau 3 channel, and in the gap modulation case, the order parameter variation enters in the tau 1 channel. Okay, so as I said, at first I want to reconsider the potential scattering model and like try to show into which problems we ran as we want when we simply wanted to interpret the effect of the dopants as potential scatterers. So let's at first if you start with the case, let's assume the dopant atoms, because they're out of plane, they're poorly screened, so they will have a long range potential, and the overall potential landscape will be very smooth. So what would we expect in this limit? In this limit, we would expect that actually the local density of states follows very closely the local chemical potential or the local filling. And if we simply consider the gap magnitude, so if we simply solve the gap equation for a constant pair interaction with the different local filling factors, we really find that the gap obviously depends a lot on filling. So in agreement with experiment, we would actually expect that the coherence peak or the gap varies throughout the sample quite a lot. So this here would be the corresponding local density of state curve. So in agreement with experiment, we would find that as a function of local filling, the position of the coherence peak would move quite a lot throughout the sample. But in disagreement with the experiment, one would find the wrong relation between the height of the coherence peak and the gap magnitude. Namely, in the case when we have a large gap, we find large coherence peaks, and in cases where there's a small gap, we find small coherence peaks. So the reason for this is, of course, twofold. The one is simple BCS reasoning. The larger the gap, of course, the more weight will be pushed into the coherence peak. And the other effect is the band structure effect. Because of the tight binding band structure, we have a von Hove peak. And the von Hove peak coincides with the coherence peak exactly at the maximum gap value. So there are two effects which sort of which contribute to the fact that we have the largest gap for the largest gap value. Yeah, well, here's a little bit of the shadow von Hove. Here, the von Hove actually changes size at the point of the maximum gap. At first, it's on the negative side, then here it's on the positive side for the function. So,
okay, but when von Hove is still far away, you do have a growth of the
yeah. Well, so this will then, I think, be simply the BCS argument.
And is the main physical reason why you have those giant peaks because the Van Hove singularity comes to the zone?
Yeah, that's what I think, yeah. So the peaks are so giant in this case, or in the half-filling case without T primes because the Van Hove coincides with the coherence peak, with some additional weight. Okay, so far the reasoning. So, well, that's the many impurity BDG calculations say. So here is the local density along a line cut for many impurity calculation. Here in the middle panel is the impurity potential, so that's very smooth. On the right panel, for comparison, I've shown the density of states according to the sort of local approximation as used before. So simply taking the density of states of a translation invariant system as a respective filling. Obviously, these two panels look pretty similar, but this also means that even in the many impurity calculation, in the self-consistent many impurity calculation, we run into the same problem as referred to before. Namely, that we have the wrong correlation between the gap values and the coherence peaks. So that means in small gap regions, we have small coherence peaks, and in large gap regions, we have large coherence peaks. In addition, we have find some particle hole asymmetry of the spectra. You can see this here on the positive side due to the von Hove singularity. And this particle hole asymmetry is also not observed experimentally. Furthermore, if one tries to compare the gap variations to experiment, when we find that they are actually too smooth. So of course, one possibility to make the gap vary more rapidly would be to consider a more short-range potential. This is also interesting from the point of view that because then all this local approximation reasoning as referred to right now will not be valid anymore in the case you have a more short range potential.
What do you mean? Mm-hmm. Can you explain again what the local, I just to understand what the local approximation
is. Oh, the local approximation is just I have the impurity potential given at a certain point, I calculate the respective filling or the respective chemical potential, and this is simply plotting the local density of state for a translation invariant system with this for this respective chemical potential. Yeah. And plotting the local density state for this chemical potential.
So then why did one fold, you said one fold showed up on the positive side and nothing on the negative side, whereas in the previous slide?
Yeah, so that just means that we're in this region. So that's just the potential along this line cut. Not the pair potential, this is for the conventional potential. So tau three potential.
This is something very big.
But that's, yeah. But this is basically the input. So that's the input impurity potential, but this is the self-consistent DDG calculation, which also.
So why do you have such large variations in the gap here? I mean, how big is your T? Is this a large?
Well, you see,
potential or?
Well, it's going up to 2T, but it has sort of an offset, so it just varies about T maybe. But as
so what you're doing is you're shifting, you're saying you're shifting local potential.
Yes. So, but if you vary here, well, so if you vary here, the chemical potential by T, we have huge, I mean, in the translation invariant system, huge gap modulation, so that's potentially possible.
Maybe
even very strong diesel, I mean. Yes. Yeah. Well, not the bandwidth, but half a T is already enough, but yes. Okay, so what would happen? Now let's forget about this very smooth limit. Let's look at the opposite limit. Let's have a very short, consider the case that we have a very short range tau 3 potentials due to the dopant atoms. Okay, some insight into this situation, what would happen then can be simply gained by reconsidering the well-known results for single potential impurity. So let's consider the fact, the situation that we have a single potential scalar tau 3 impurity. This is the local density of state on the impurity side, black without impurity potential, and then red and green for some small and repulsive impurity potential. And what we can see is that indeed it looks like the coherence peak on the negative y side sort of gained some weight. But what is clearly evident from this picture is that this effect is very part of the whole asymmetry. So although it looks like the coherence peak here on the negative y side gains some weight or even sharpens up here, exactly the opposite happens on the positive y side. So that means if you have like short range tau 3 scattering, this will introduce a strong particle hole asymmetry. So what happens if the impurity potential is stronger? If the impurity potential is stronger, then the resonance starts to move into the gap region, which would also be in contradiction to experiment because the experiment shows very homogeneous low energy density of states and no sub-gap states.
Yes? From the plot, actually, for V equals 0, it's clear that one hole is almost hitting the gap, right? It's
yes.
Very well. So
yeah.
Move one hole far out.
Yeah.
What is that, or the tau 1 impurity?
But that's, I'm sorry, the tau 3 impurity. So
tau 3.
This is still discussing tau 3.
Okay.
But you.
So
that's. No, yeah. Just reminding everybody what is, I'm just trying to summarize what is, so to say, what is against the tau 3, what problems arise in the tau 3 model. Okay, so this was the single impurity reasoning. So what happens in the many impurity case? Again, we observe basically the same features as in the single impurity case. This is again a line cut through now a spiky potential landscape. We find that the weight and the coherence peak is very particle hole asymmetric, like in the single impurity case. We already, at some places where the impurity potential is strong, we already have the formation of some subgap state that destroy the homogeneity of the low energy L loss. And also we find very large charge modulations. So here would be a map of the charge modulations by factor of 2. Okay, so since we run into many problems with this tau 3 scattering scenario, we know that there are gap modulations, so what happens if the quasi particles don't really feel the tau 3 potential of the dopant atoms, but basically just feel and are scattered by gap modulations that could be introduced by a dopant modulated pair interaction. So let's again consider at first the single impurity calculation. So let's assume there are some gap modulations, and let's assume they're sort of very short range. So what would happen? So this panel shows what would happen if the quasi particles are scattered at an order parameter suppression. Again, black denotes the normal density of states. Blue denotes the density of states if the order parameter is just suppressed on the four bonds surrounding the purity side. And the red curve is if the order parameter is suppressed in a slightly larger region. Of course, we know that in the case of order parameter modulation, the scattering is of Andreev type. So this explains the remarkable particle hole symmetry of the spectra. And what we see in the case of an order parameter suppression is that we have a new Andreev resonance which starts to form just below the gap edge. And so now this new resonance moves into the gap region. The stronger the order parameter is suppressed, or the more extended the region of the order parameter suppression is. So the new resonance moves into the gap region and sharpens up.
So what's the value of the gap?
It's 0.4. Well, here, I think the order parameter was suppressed to zero on the four bonds. And this one was also suppressed to zero, but in a slightly larger region, maybe. Not only four bonds, but in a circle, so slightly more region.
Okay. This is not
self-consistent. No, that's T matrix. Yes, that's good. But I think this is basically what happens. I mean, so now in the BDD, we sort of produce the order parameter modulation via modulation of the pair interaction, but what happens is exactly this scattering physics, which sort of gives rise to the variation of the Korean sticks. So I think the basic physics can be understood by simply putting in by hand and looking at the T matrix itself. And of course, exactly the opposite happens in the case of an order parameter enhancement. Again, blue is the order parameter enhanced just in four bonds, and this is a slightly more extended region. In this case, the coherence peak moves outwards, and the intensity of the coherence peak is suppressed. And at this point, I should say that similar results have also been obtained by Capriotti and Scalapino in the case of more extended order parameter patches.
If one suppresses the pair, mm-hmm. It will not be expected that this will also trigger intensity modulations, because at that particular part of the phase, the electron cannot really gain so much energy in the phase.
Well, actually, I will show the charge density later in this, actually, in the next panel. So this is then the results for, again, the elders for many, many impurity BDD calculations. We now assume that the impurity changed the pair interaction. And this is actually the charge, so the density map. And here we find that the charge density varies only by, let's say, 2%, so only minimally. So if you change the Well, the gap varies here between, let's say, by a factor of 2.
By a factor of 2, and the density by a few percent.
Yeah, only 2%.
So this is the charge rate for one value of omega v. How big is
zero? The pair, you mean the... Okay, so this is now a calculation where we modulate the pair interaction. And to be concrete, so... if we just consider single impurity, like how much a single impurity modulates the pair interactions, so then directly below the impurity, the pair interactions increase by 30%. Yeah, well.
So that's good numbers.
Yeah, but so but V, okay, so the point is because V, so V is a site variable, and G is a bond variable, and so I basically have to take the average of two adjacent sites. So it's a little bit hard to directly take the numbers and add it as the consider the pair. So you basically have to take the average always between two neighboring points.
One zero and one and one, so it will be
coupled. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And on the naked pair interaction is of the order of few. So it's 30%. Pardon me? Delta? Oh, delta is 0.40. So it's pretty large here.
In simple purity calculation, you could almost take the spectrum as the peak, the tip.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And whereas in this calculation,
yeah.
I don't see any.
Okay, so basically also what happens here is we assume basically we are more the opposite limit, because we assume that impurity increase the pair parameter. So basically, if we have a small concentration of impurity, we will have the small regions with enhanced order parameter, so with suppressed coherence peak. So if we really want to have the opposite limit to see this nice peak dip feature, we would maybe need some impurities which decrease the pair interaction, or the other impurities need to be so extended so that we really have some regions in between enhanced gap order parameter, enhanced pair interaction values, that you have these little nice valleys in order to really produce these nice resonances. So I think this is the reason why, although I think the coherence peaks here are already slightly enhanced, also because of the fact, because they're in between these enhanced values, it's not as strong as in the previous figure, but we pretty strongly see the other effect that we have in regions where there are the dopant atoms and the enhanced pair interaction, we have the suppressed coherence peaks.
Maybe this is a possibility to
actually. Yes. But I think so. I mean, if one sort of averages over.
Can I ask you something on this also?
Yes. This one here?
Yeah.
That's just a finite size effect. This is just a finite size effect. This is just because it's a finite size system and we didn't maybe use a large enough broadening. And because in the tau 3 case, because the scattering affects all energy ranges, this sort of smears out naturally. But in this case, because the low energy density state is not so much affected by scattering, this finite size effect. I mean, you would also have this in the homogeneous system. I mean, if you have no impurity scattering. So this just means that the finite size effect are here so strong and are not smeared out. It's just indication that these low energy density of sites not so much affected by.
You know, this is a finite size effect, or you think?
Yes, I'm pretty sure, because it's also there in the homogeneous system. So I mean, if you do a calculation of a translation invariant system, this will also be there.
It goes away if it becomes bigger.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so maybe I don't, just to summarize the main points, now we find the right anticorrelation between dopant positions and the gap magnitude. We have small charge modulations and the low energy of density effects very homogeneous. Maybe just one more point about the anticorrelation of the peak height and the gap magnitude. So when, an analogy to the experiments, you can also plot gap maps and peak height maps. So we simply plot the position of the coherence peak in the two-dimensional map and the height of the respective peak, where the height is in an inverse color scale, so same color should be anticorrelated. So one can see that these red regions coincide with red regions here, so they're clearly anticorrelated. This is also obvious if one calculates the correlation function, which gives minus 0.6, so minus 1 would be 100% anticorrelated. Okay, so I have some short time. I would maybe on two slides mention what happens if you consider the Fourier transform. So we know from the experimental end of the Fourier transform, you see these nice peaks in the Fourier transform, which have been interpreted as arising from quasi-particle interference. And the wave vector at which these peaks appear are simply interpreted as the wave vectors which connect the points of the maximum density of states, or the tip of the bananas. And so what would happen, what would you expect as a Fourier transform pattern if you consider tau 1 scattering instead of the normal potential scattering? In order to see this, one can simply take the order parameter modulation 4 of 1 and Fourier transform this. And then one would see that if one finds that the matrix element which scatters one particle from k1 to k2 is actually proportional to the sum of delta k1 plus delta k2. So the two delta values of the initial and the final wave vector. So what does it mean? This simply means that now the matrix element vanishes between these red points if they belong to opposite sign of the gap. So that means many of these quasi-particle peaks would actually disappear in the tau 1 case, and we expect a signal only at the Q1 peak, at the Q4 and the Q5 peak. And now if you assume that these autoparameter modulations are even more extended, this would sort of suppress the large Q wave vectors, and we would expect to have a predominant Q1 scattering due to autoparameter modulation. How does the Fourier transform pattern look like from now a single tau 1 impurity? Here the lower panel shows for several subgap energies the Fourier transform pattern. For comparison, the upper row shows the Fourier transform pattern in case of a conventional point-like tau 3 scatterer. So I just want to point out two main differences. Like many of these background features which dominate the Fourier transform pattern in the tau 3 case, which are not so obvious in the experimental figures, disappear in the case of tau 1 scattering, simply because this interference between positive and negative gaps not only refers to the Q, to this peaks, but also to the background features. And also, especially for larger energies, we have very clear here in the circle, very strong Q1 peak in the tau 1 scattering case, which is almost absent in the tau 3 scattering case. And this has always been a mystery why this Q1 peak is much, much more pronounced in experiments than the tau 3 scattering would predict. So maybe tau 1 scattering could help to explain why the Q1 peak is very strong. Yeah, I haven't done this, so that's something we should do. You mean to plot a dispersion of the Q1 peak? Oh. So. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, so it definitely disperses inwards. Yeah. It's a standard. Yeah. It's just that the other Q vectors are suppressed, basically. And so only the Q1 shows up.
Is Q5 outside that field of view? Is that why we don't see?
Probably, yeah. So everything else what we see here is just background features. I mean, these things are just background features, so they're not Q7 because Q7 should not be there. In Q7, we also have the wrong distortion. So these are sort of only background features. Okay, so maybe one last slide. Am I already over time? Okay. What could be the origin of this parent-interaction modulation? Of course, we don't have a microscopic model, but what one could think if this oxygen opens the non-stoichiometric matrix, so they're sort of somewhere pushed into the lattice, and this will, of course, probably lead to some local lattice distortions. So local lattice distortions could change either the local electron-phonon interaction, or they could also modify the super-exchange interaction locally. Because the super-exchange actually is very, very sensitive on the distance. It has, for example, been found in Raman and pressure-dependent Raman measurements on the parent compound, lanthanum copper oxide. J goes with 1 over R, roughly to the 7th power. So in the best case scenario, when like the copper distance is simply shrink due to the oxygen, due to the oxygen dopant atom, and we need like a 30% increase for our model of the parent reaction below the oxygen atom. This would correspond to taking this J dependence. This would correspond to a 4% reduction of the copper-copper distance, which does not seem too unreasonable, but it's completely unclear whether the dopant atom will have this favorable lattice distortion, of course. Okay, and so I'm finished. Maybe I'll just leave the conclusions. You want to have the microphone?
I had mentioned the calculation that Sapriati had done.
I thought I would just mention it because it's related, I believe, to the same sort of effect. What's going on is, here's a, I think it was 200 by 200 and then I mean 400 by 400 calculation you did, where he comes in and takes this section, this piece of greater section, 3 by 3, which happens to be a 5 by 5. So on this 5 by 5 model, which is just like the model you talked about, a U-wave DCS, in the lower graph, the gap has simply been, E-wave has simply been suppressed to zero, and it drops by half all the surrounding plot. So it's simply a suppression of it, and then you ask what happens. And what happens is, as Mara was saying, if you start in the center, and now we're just going to walk out. In the center, we're still inside the cluster where the gap's been suppressed, and now by the time you get to the yellow, we're outside. And so what happens is, in the center, you get these extremely high resonances. Note the scale change, 3 and 1.2. You get the high resonance. By the time you go to 0.2, which is just on the edge, you're back to the green, and by the time you go just outside, you're in the yellow, and you're returning very close to the bulk time. So we were surprised how rapidly this thing could happen in this really simple model. Then up above, it's the same thing, only on the 5 by 5, the gap's going to double. And so when you double it, what happens here is if you start at the blue, then you have these very broad systems, very broad, again, pushed out peaks. And then as you go outside, you return to what would be the CCS E-wave form. And it may look large here, but again, the scale's been changed. There are also some features inside that now listen to you. I worry a finite size effect. I had thought originally, I'm trying to now find the 400 by 400 to be good to see what we were there.
This means
some other things done to simplify it. This is T prime equals zero, chemical potential set to zero, and so you have no Van Hove problem. You're just looking at what I would call a very simplest model. And the main point was, as you said, and the point that I think is being made here with some of Capitulnik's data, is once again the puzzle that had always puzzled some of us as to the size of the coherency, what it might mean. So very similar to
Okay.
A simpler calculation. It's not self-consistent.
Well, I pointed out to Tamara yesterday, and I should point out to you that we have been reporting for a number of years that there's one other major characteristic of those shock peaks inside those little domains, and it's that they're modulated in space. If you have a domain, let's make this to be the lattice. So this is one unit cell. Okay, so the peaks are modulated. The magnitude of those peaks are modulated with a period of being one unit cell. Or if you translate that into momentum space, there's intense scattering from here to here and from here to here. That's one of the strongest of all possible characteristics of what's observed inside these domains. And I bet it probably contains the information necessary to determine what the actual mechanism is of this.
That A naught is not Z, couple of them.
Say again, please.
What is the A naught in this
variable? It's
the unit cell of the CO
complex. So that's just the modulation from atoms.
Correct.
Okay.
So typically a theorist will say, because Q is 2 pi over 4 A naught, it's irrelevant. But in a translationally invariant system, that's not true. It's highly relevant. It's a standing wave inside a box.
Yeah, I was wondering, well, we are discussing both cases that the gap is decreased or enhanced. Let's say we simply throw it to a modular form, you need an enhancement of the third.
and yes. You could get some features for those.
Why? Because the experiment seems to observe that the oxygen are correlated with large gap regions, so that's the way.
But could you also tell what would be your finding if you were locally assuming the reduction?
Well, then we would still find like a anticorrelation between gap magnitude and peak height, but of course we will find an anticorrelation of the gap magnitude to the oxygen positions, and not a positive correlation. Then this would be the basic difference.
Alright.
But even if the calculation is not consistent, at the level of the purity average, you are at, so to speak, self-consistent one-particle problem. We are in two dimensions. If you can look at the wave functions of the solution of the Bode-Lugin equations. Is there any sign of localization of the Bode-Lugin particles? Could you attribute something like the localization length to them? Maybe the question is twofold. Would the Bode-Lugin quasi particles localize or not? And if so, is the disorder strong enough to look at, let's say, an exponential envelope? Is the system large enough to look at them?
I don't know. I didn't look at this, but it would probably be interesting just to plot the wave functions and see how kind of they are.
Yeah. Bill looked at the problem with concrete scatterers some years ago, and
we considered much stronger scatterers, so unitary scatterers, than was being considered here. In those cases, Bill correctly, the localization ones tend to become more than the system size. In which case, I'm assuming the localization length is considerably larger.
This is a weak scatter.
It's a weak scatter.
How large was it from back then with the entire scattering?
Depends how much disorder you put in.
What kind of? Order of
Yeah. Yeah, I like to make a comment and ask a question. In the early on explanation of this inhomogeneity is through screening, basically. And we interpret this large coherence peak in the small gap region as being the system has a lot of coherence, as being farther away from the insulating state. And in the case where you have large gaps, mm-hmm. small coherence peak, that's closer mm-hmm. to happening, I guess. Mm-hmm. What is the big problem with that? Is it because the oxygen, since I wasn't here when Shim was giving the talk, is it because there is no charging homogeneity, or what? Because that explains the anticorrelation and everything, and it explains from the potential point of view.
So the proposal was that the dopant atoms would be in the high hole density, low gap.
Right. Okay. So.
But that's not what it turns out.
Right. What could have happened is oxygen clustering, right? These holes that you induce under the oxygens, part of them could be localized.
Oh yeah.
Right? It's very strong potential, and the itinerant hole actually is even smaller. But the itinerant hole concentration under the oxygen clustering regions could be even smaller, and therefore you're closer to half filling. And you actually have a bigger gap with reduced coherence. But the main thing, I thought the main objection is actually you seem to say, and she quotes, that the oxygen is almost, the dopant is almost uniform, or the charge is almost uniform. But that is really integrating all the way up to very high frequency,
very high energy. And I've been very careful about that, what has been integrated over.
And it's integrating over all the orbitals.
All the orbitals, you including the non-bounding oxygens almost, right, near 1 eV. Well,
You're not quite,
but in the bismuth oxygen layer, we know there's stuff around 250 milliEV. The semiconducting gap is only that big.
You've got to screen these charged ions in some way.
Right. Yeah, okay.
So the empirical fact is that if you integrate this function in the measured differential conductance as a function of the bias voltage, if you integrate this function out to say here, which was what was possible in the early days of the experiment, then the fluctuations in this number are very large.
That's about 250?
150, that's what we could be originally. Now there's an oxygen impurity state out here someplace, and we have to stay away from it because it produces a huge perturbation. So now we, if we integrate out almost to minus 900, then the RMX fluctuations of the integral under this line are below 10%.
Yeah, but
So that's conventionally associated with the number of holes. I don't know what the proof is that this integral here counts the number of holes
I don't think there is any relation to the holes in a single band.
Yeah.
Right? In RPAS, you never integrate even beyond 500 because you know there are other bands you're integrating. Right? And in this case, you also see some charge, some transfer of spectral weight even actually.
Correct.
Right? To that high energy. Correct. So again, that says you cannot just integrate to 900.
I was just going to say, it's true that, you know, you can't know which states are localized and which are delocalized.
Right.
But from the point of view of the Coulomb potential, that doesn't make any difference.
Well, the thing is how many charges you've included, right? How many types of charges? We want the charges that goes to that single band that crossing through the Fermi level.
Justin, she made a point about the tau 3 disorder, about the charges.
Tau 3 disorder is there, like Arnold said yesterday. If you have potential disorder, you're generating tau 1, tau 3, all of them are there.
It's true.
Yeah. In fact, strictly speaking,
for tau 3 disorder, you don't need to take comparable for what they do, but putting those in tau 3, you will have substantial particle hole asymmetries in the lower part of the spectrum. This is the second part of the argument. And I don't know, maybe you know how to address it. I don't know how to make it symmetric. We move quite seriously in the impurity source.
Which, what is symmetric? I'm missing this.
Why do you call it symmetry of the spectrum? You start producing brain. If you start playing with the disorder potentials on the scale of T, you start producing the inside the gap resonances. And they work on one side of the bias or another. And we are not seeing this in the tunneling data.
You're far away from unitary limits in this outplane.
Yeah,
you're
out of plane.
Yeah, you don't have the
outplane. Producing 10-20% of scattering. You cannot be far off of the unity. You cannot make it total density gradient of the order of 10%.
Can you actually enlighten us on what is the particle hole symmetry or asymmetry?
But I'm so not.
We'll look at this tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. So, Sacha,
exactly
you want to
do that
session for discussion?
Right? Yeah.
Why don't we do this tomorrow morning?
Okay.
Otherwise, we have to cover only two speakers on their flight. So let's get at the end.
I don't want to cut the discussion, but we're going to
do it.
The speakers keep the half an hour. Exactly what we were asking for. Forum where we can all
pointer? Okay. Is this on? Yeah. Okay. Okay, good morning. I have to thank the organizers for giving me this chance to speak here, and especially I have Seamus's blessings now. So hopefully I can begin. Okay, I'm going to talk about, very much the topic of this workshop, nanoscale inhomogeneities in 2D metal insulator transitions. Before that, I want to answer David Gross's question, what is complexity? And I should say, here is complexity. This is Picasso's, maybe not mine, but at least Picasso's complexity. And we've seen a lot of examples of this in a number of talks on many different systems. And at least as a theorist, what one is trying to do is distill out of this complexity some kind of simplicity and hopefully, be able to get some deeper understanding of the phenomena. So, keep this sequence of bulls in mind. So this is what we are confronted with. This is the phase diagram we are all familiar with. And the reason, from a theoretical point of view, it's extremely challenging because three major paradigms that we have grown up with are all breaking down in the context of the cuprates. And those paradigms are basically band theory fails at x equal to 0,
because the parent insulator, which is half filled, is not metallic but is a Mott antiferromagnetic insulator. The second paradigm that fails is Landau's Fermi liquid theory, because the normal state is very far from normal, at least in these two cases. And the third paradigm that fails is BCS theory in this D-wave strongly correlated superconducting state, again, at least in this optimally and underdoped regime. Furthermore, we have all kinds of competing orders that we have heard about during this workshop in this regime, and you know, this is something that wasn't really discussed, but there might also be more interesting critical points. So this is the problem we are confronted with, and the approach we took is to start with this phase, because this is the most interesting phase, and that is why, you know, that's what gets its name. It's the D-wave superconducting state, and I would say by now we have a very good understanding of this phase microscopically, and we can make many connections with experiments. So the analog of the BCS wave function for the superconducting state is now this state. It is, you may give it your name. It used to be called the RVD state. Many people have strong reactions to that name. Well, we just call it the projected state. And the physics of this is extremely simple. You start out here with essentially a BCS state with D-wave pairing, and then you put in the physics of the strong correlations coming from such a projection operator. This strongly builds on the early work of Phil Anderson, who proposed this state. Pictorially, this is what it looks like. This is the lattice. You throw down some up and down electrons, and then you can pair them into these singlets. So these bonds here are the singlet bonds. They're not necessarily nearest neighbor singlets. They can have longer ranges as well. And that is dictated by this pair wave function phi. So essentially, this state here describes macroscopic occupation of the paired state phi by n over 2 pairs, all of them in the same phase. And that's how it has long-range phase coherence. Then comes this operator P, which basically says that because there is a strong U, none of these sites are doubly occupied. So you have essentially singly occupied sites. And we build in one more important physics, which is that U is not infinite. It is finite. So you must allow for some double occupancy, which generates, which is done by this unitary operator here, and that generates the antiferromagnetic scale for you. So this is basically the wave function that describes that D-wave strongly correlated state. And how do we know it works? Well, the first thing it produces for us is the very important physics that we see in the high TC cube rates, that instead of one energy scale, which is basically the pairing gap and the order parameter, which are identical in the BCS case, these are two, you get two very different energy scales in the high TC cube rates, and that feature comes out from just putting in strong correlations in this wave function. So here is the proof for that. This is the pairing amplitude as a function of doping, and you can see it has this X dependence, very much like the T star scale. On the other hand, the order parameter, which is obtained from long-range pairing correlations, has more of a TC variation. Now, many people would like to attribute competing orders in order to get these two energy scales. The point we are making is that could be additional physics going on, but again, keeping in mind that bull picture I showed you in terms of a minimal model, here is a problem where all we put in are the strong correlations, and that is able to produce these two different scales. Okay, so this is known. Yeah.
Is that variational delta, is that when you solve this thing self-consistently, is that also equal to the pair correlation? What I'm getting at is, does that delta tell you anything about the spectral gap, or is it variational?
At this point, it was a variational parameter, but we have later on gone on to show that it is also, it's not identical to the gap, but it is proportional to the gap. I don't have a picture here, but it is so in this wave function, right now it is just a variational parameter, and this is its variation. To show that it is a gap, what we have done is to write down a wave function, BCS wave function, with a broken pair, okay? And then projected that state and looked at its energy, and that indeed comes out to be, it has the same x dependence as this, but if I look at delta over gap, there is a factor of about 3 or 4, which is independent of x. And that agrees with ARPES as well. Yeah. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, we don't really understand that in detail. That is, you know, we do these variational Monte Carlo calculations, and this is what we are finding. So that's why we have not published that yet. We are still trying to understand the origin of that factor. And when I say understand, what we are trying to do is to now back off from this Monte Carlo calculations and do something more approximate, more Gutzwiller approximation type calculations in order to get some insight into some of these results. So that's why this result is not yet published. Yeah.
When you say variation, it means variation with respect to energy or free energy. So it means a Hamiltonian must be there.
Right. I have skipped all of that because, I have this, so the Hamiltonian, so partly the reason I skipped the Hamiltonian is we feel the more important physics is really in the wave function, okay? But still, as you say, we have to put in a Hamiltonian, so we have used a Hubbard model with parameters T, T prime, and U, which are determined from experiments. So T, T prime determined from ARPES, and J gives us, from neutron scattering, which gives us U. So we've put in those parameters in a one-band Hubbard model. And then we take this wave function, we calculate the energy, and we minimize it with respect to the parameters.
Can you assume some relation between the J and the U scale? Because
the
U to the IS,
So the way, so the J, so we just put in a U, a value of U in the Hubbard model, and the E to the IS comes in because now all operators that we work with, not just in the Hamiltonian, even very importantly, for example, in the order parameter, you have to evaluate this in a wave function that has the E to the IS. Yes.
We project that onto the ground state with the square lattice Hamiltonian. The overlap essentially goes to zero as the system size grows, because the other D state is not a both variational state for the magnetic state. So now, if you will do the same thing and take a Hubbard model and a projector quantum Monte Carlo for the ground state with the system, and then you take your variational state.
We have not done this. If you can do it, that would be great. If you can do the projector Monte Carlo on this. Sorella has had this issue.
So you would say the Undo case is special.
No, let me comment on that. The Undo. So what we are, this was one of the reasons that this Anderson's original idea was actually trashed, because Anderson had proposed this state for the x equal to zero antiferromagnet as a spin liquid state. And, finally it was found that the state actually had long range order, so this wave function was considered to be doomed. But what my philosophy is, first of all, I should say it is a variational wave function. I cannot prove anything about the true ground state. I can just say, here is a state which looks rather good. It has some interesting correlations. Let us proceed with that and see to what extent it can describe the experiment. So that's the philosophy of what I'm doing. Now let me say about the antiferromagnetic question. That is happening around here. Okay, that's another interesting question one should look at. The problem I'm not claiming is already solved. Okay, I'm just looking at this region over here. This superconductor is originating in a problem that does not have long-range order to begin with. So it is already in some kind of a spin liquid state, which this wave function can describe.
Well, maybe so, maybe not. Because this one score is indicated it could be repeating any
So let me say something very interesting on that point. This wave function is not a benign wave function at all. It has some very interesting antiferromagnetic correlations. Okay? So even though it does not have long-range order, and this wasn't the main part of my talk, so I don't have that data. But if you look at the spin-spin correlation function, in this wave function at x equal to zero, it is not short-ranged at all. It has a power law which goes like 1 over r to the 3 halves. So it is kind of on the brink of being able to get, being able to get ordered. So that's why I think it's a very good candidate. Now on your question about the vortex cores and impurities, okay? So this wave function, again, there are some technical difficulties why this has not been done, but essentially if you put an impurity, let's say at some point, and like Seamus Davis has done these experiments, and also Alul has done the magnetic, has looked at the magnetic structure around the impurities, and you see there is antiferromagnetic correlations over some range. This wave function does contain these antiferromagnetic correlations on some length scale. So it has the potential to be able to generate that. Okay, so from many points of view, qualitatively, it is really worth pursuing these wave functions and seeing how far we can go with it. You know, I have no love lost for these. If the moment they stop working somewhere, we know we have to improve it. We will have to do that. But the main point is, let's start with this really simple looking state. Let's not put too much complexity to begin with and just push it and see how far we can go with these. You know, if they don't work, fine, we have to drop it and go on to something else. But at least so far, many quantities that we have compared with in angle-resolved photoemission studies have worked out really even quantitatively. So I will show you those. I was only going to show you one key new result, because some of this work has been talked about earlier. So the main thing that a theorist should do is to be able to make predictions, and we try hard to do that, but some of these are kind of minor predictions. So this is not sort of a great prediction, but anyway, it seems to have been borne out more recently, so I'll describe that. There's also the tunneling asymmetry and the extraction of the local hole density, which Seamus talked about, so I won't touch on that. So this is the quantity I want to look at. As you know, this is the Fermi surface. These are the nodal points where the gap opens up, and there are some interesting properties of these nodal quasiparticles. So one of the things in the experiments that we know, as a function of doping, the Fermi surface does not change very much, and it is a large Fermi surface. Well, that comes out of these projected wave functions. We do indeed get a large Fermi surface, but the quasiparticle weight is becoming smaller and smaller as x goes towards half filling. Now, another quantity is the velocity of these quasiparticles. Okay, so this is a quantity we had calculated. These squares here are quantum Monte Carlo calculations, or rather these variational Monte Carlo calculations, whereby using some ideas of moments, we are able to extract the velocity of these quasiparticles as a function of x. And what you see is it's fairly doping independent. Many other approximate methods gave strong doping dependence. Now recently, so this was in 2001, a couple of years back from ZX Shen's group, there was this data where they looked at these quasiparticle velocities as a function of x. So this is the energy versus the momentum vector, and the slope gives us the velocity. Okay, and you can see for a wide range of dopings, the velocity is constant. And not just that it's a constant, pretty amazingly, if you take the slope, the number comes out to be bang around 2 electron volts, volt angstrom. So that's more than I would have ever expected out of this theory, but you know, we were pretty ecstatic about that. So, okay, so that's, yeah. Yes. Yes. So, so among the Gutzwiller approximation things we have tried, it gets many things right. For example, it is able to more or less get the quasi-particle weight as a function of x correctly. But the velocity it has not been able to get. And the physics behind that is that the self-energy that you, the structure of the self-energy in k and omega is very, has singularities in both k and omega. And these are cancelled in order to produce this constant. And somehow that is not captured by the very, you know, sort of simplistic approximation.
But it is an approximation, it's just this sort of accounting argument that gives you
an argument. Right. Right.
If you change the d primes that enter in the parameter, could you get also this flat?
We haven't done a global search of this kind, but t prime is an important issue. And, you know, we heard a couple of talks where people mentioned Ole Anderson's work, that T prime is correlated with, TC. And so we looked into that. We were actually even collaborating with Ole Anderson's group to use the band structure that they extract after downfolding as a function of, let's say, lanthanum, yttrium, barium, mercury, and so on. And we wanted to see if we put in that band structure with more, with the actual T primes, and they actually have up to T to the 9, you know, talk of simplicity. But so we were putting in that band structure to see if it would correlate. What we found, the difficulty was we didn't get a value for U. So from these downfolding methods, they can give you a band structure, epsilon of K, but the value of U was something that, we were stuck at. So we are inconclusive at this point.
What if you fixed you, what did you find?
If we fixed you, we didn't see the correct correlation. We saw an anti-correlation, in fact. So, yeah. Okay, so now the next thing, of course, we would like to... So naturally, from this model, we do get a picture for the pseudo-gap phase. Maybe there is not one pseudo-gap phase, but different, many pseudo-gap phases because of other competing orders. But there is a definite picture that emerges from such a wave function for the pseudo-gap phase. Basically, when you reach a temperature on the order of delta, you start getting pairing correlations or, you know, sort of pairs, but they are incoherent. And when you reach a lower temperature on the order of the superfluid stiffness on that energy scale, then you get long-range coherence. So that's the picture that emerges. But what we are trying to do is to extend these calculations to actually look at the feature in ARPES that has come out about these Fermi arcs. So that story, I think you will hear sometime soon. But now I want to shift gears a little bit, because we've talked a lot about disorder in this workshop. And as I was listening to these talks, sort of the obvious question that comes to a theorist is disorder somehow essential to understand the high TC cube rates, or, you know, just somehow a necessary nuisance that we have to deal with? And what I have to say on that is my take on this is actually, I would say that high TC should be understood without really any putting in any disorder. But at the present, the only way we have to add carriers to the Mott insulator is by stoichiometric doping, which, in addition to adding carriers, also necessarily adds the disorder.
I know there's trouble with this material, but there's the two-leg stoichiometric. I believe there's a lot of trouble with that material. But that would... And then I guess if you believe ortho 1 is really ordered...
I guess the problem with, you know, these different materials is you would like to have one material, you know, theorist dream, perfectly clean, and on that you should have all the data. Now the data is on the Bismuth systems for the most part from ARPES and STM, and those necessarily have a lot of disorder as we saw from Seamus. So that's the disentangling is what is difficult. And nevertheless, I've put down this hope that, notwithstanding that, we will have gated systems at some point, and then the chemical potential can be changed without adding disorder, and we can separate out these two features.
Do you know anybody doing this now?
Seamus mentioned some people. And I think Takagi mentioned some. And Takagi mentioned. Right.
Is the main reason the barrier oxide technology problem?
So anyway, in the meantime, we have these disordered systems, and what can we learn from them? And I think one of the interesting windows that I got from hearing some of the talks was, given a nominal doped sample, there were these regions with very different behavior. So it was as if, in one sample, different local doped regions were produced, and you got a window into what this x-axis was doing in a single sample. So that's actually an advantage of having a disordered system, that you can look at a range of X in a single sample. Then, of course, we have seen that disorder can act as a probe of the symmetry of the order parameter. And also, by looking at what happens around these impurities, we can tell that about the nature of the correlation. So it acts like an investigator of the correlations in it. So it's not totally a bad thing to have disorder. So now what I'm going to do is, this was sort of the main part, is I'm going to add disorder to this phase diagram, but this will go very quickly. I'm going to now add disorder to this phase diagram, but at a very particular point, at exactly half filling, because we understand the system here in some ways better, and then one can move on. And the main question I want to ask is, we are starting out with a Mott insulator with a large gap and long-range antiferromagnetic order, and let's say I add disorder to the system, the question I want to ask is, which of these scales is going to get killed first? Now, you may think that because J is a smaller scale, it's T square over U, that will get killed first, but what I will show you is actually the Mott gap closes before long-range antiferromagnetic order is killed. Yes. So the disorder I'm looking at, yeah, that's very important. And we have looked at the other both types. So the types are disorder that breaks particle hole symmetry and disorder that does not break particle hole symmetry. They have completely different effects. But I have 15 minutes. So I'm going to focus on. I have two. Okay, I had 15. Okay, let me just show you the punchline. Punchline is very easy to tell because I was groomed by Leibovitz. In 5 minutes, we could tell our results. So here it is, 2 minutes. So what comes out? So it's basically we look at a Hubbard model with local disorder. Okay, that is disordered from site to site. So it is something that breaks particle hole symmetry.
Potential
disorder. And what we find is that this is a checkered antiferromagnetic pattern that is getting destroyed as you add disorder to it. So no surprise there. But in fact, some of the destruction of this can actually be modeled in terms of some of the work that we heard from Grevin and with regard to like dilution models and what Tomas and Jörg have also worked on. But let me not focus on that. Let us look at now what happens to the gap. So here is the gap in the density of states at weak disorder. It closes beyond some critical disorder, and that disorder strength is lower than the disorder strength at which the antiferromagnetic long-range order is killed. So now this is the punchline. Please pay attention here. What you are seeing is at low disorder, you're seeing a Mott insulator. that we all know. At high disorder, you expect some kind of a disorder-driven Anderson-type insulator. What is this state in the middle here, which has no gap because the gap has closed, but still has antiferromagnetic long-range order? And what my claim is that this state in the middle is, in fact, a percolating, inhomogeneous, antiferromagnetic metal. It's a metal. Okay, so sandwiched between two insulators is a metal. How do I know that? We have done many different studies, but let me just show you the wave functions. These are the wave functions of at the Fermi energy for the electrons in the system. And you see at disorder of 2T, this is for some parameter, the wave functions are localized. If there were no interaction, the localization length would have just shrunk more and more, and you would have gotten an ever-squeezed wave function with increasing disorder. But what you see is at some high disorder, again, the wave functions are localized. But at some intermediate disorder, which is roughly on the order of U over 2, U is the interaction scale, you get this extended state. And one can quantify it by looking at the inverse participation ratio, which tells you how many states are participating. Could this be a finite size effect? We have done finite size scaling on this quantity, and we have indeed shown that this length scale, if we do larger and larger systems, scales to becomes infinitely large. So that's the finite size scaling data there. Okay, so the physical picture, so part of the reason this is very interesting is in two dimensions, we don't expect by the scaling theory to find metals. Now the scaling theory is not exactly valid here because this is an interacting system, but nevertheless, it is very interesting that when you have interactions and disorder, they are together leading to a delocalized state. Some of the older theories basically found when they turned on interactions, it led to even more localization. So this is a very interesting competing effect of these two features.
How robust is this with regard to your choice of U over T?
Okay.
And with regard to your choice of disorder distributions?
Okay, very good question. So with regard to the disorder distributions, we have looked at binary distributions, and the same feature goes through. Binary meaning just two kinds of disorder. It does depend on, if you just put disorder which changes the bond hopping, then the results are different. But for binary versus this general disorder, box disorder, the results are the same. With regard to U and T, we have a phase diagram. So this doesn't happen everywhere, and the phase diagram is something like this. We can discuss it in more detail, but there is a VU phase diagram. In that, there is a certain region where you find a metal. And around that, there are these different types of insulators.
Let me just comment that we looked for signs of metallicity in this system I mentioned briefly, nitrogen peroxide doping, zinc, and magnesium. And anything what we found is that upon zinc magnesium doping, the system became even more insulating.
Okay. Yeah, so I think one needs to have a better idea about some of the parameter values.
You get a metal for smaller values of U.
Yes. Partly because you need, what is happening is that you have U, which prevents hopping, and disorder locally is able to allow for some hopping. But on the other hand, if the disorder that you need to do the delocalization is so large, then it just ends up localizing the states. So there is a small regime there, a small sliver of window where this feature would be seen. I can see. No, this is, we actually have a sort of, we have cuts along this and cuts along that, and there are real data points on this. Just depends on how much my graduate student worked on this. So I should end, you know, he's standing there. I should end. Let me just show this picture, because I do want you to take a picture away from the whole thing. The picture is that as you add disorder, so bottom line, what are we doing? We're adding disorder. And quite amazingly, you know, see the Mott state is a very dead state. There's no motion because nothing can move. U is strong. Now we add disorder. That generates local charge fluctuation. That is these little objects here. As we add more disorder, these local regions become larger and start percolating. And so that's the inhomogeneous metal that we are generating in the middle in this region. So that is our picture for this nanoscale inhomogeneous metal.
But again, it seems like you need to go to a deep view regime for this to happen.
Right. But I would say even in the larger regime, just understanding the transition from a MOT insulator to gapless insulator is very interesting. Because one thing I didn't talk about, you know, we are always calling it Anderson insulator, but it's really not an Anderson insulator. We have found that this region is actually very glassy, okay? And we have been able to identify what are those objects that are making it glassy. And we can discuss this a little more, but there are some, it's not just two-level systems, it's correlated chunks of two-level system type objects that change the dynamics around this region. So this metal is actually a very noisy metal. There are some data from Dragano Popovic's group, and I think those data can be understood in terms of some of these objects that are coming out here. So I think even if you're not in this very nice U regime where you get a metal, the transition from MOT insulator to the other gapless insulator can be quite interesting there, in terms of some nice glassy physics there. Okay, I think I should stop.
I encourage everybody else to combine their questions.
Thanks so much.
We want to pose a question for us, I have to say. One of these results are reporting here, but also obtained during the protective
wave. I wish they were. See, no. They are... the difficulty there is we do not know how to put in projection over an inhomogeneous system. Call me back in 1 year, I'll have some results on that. So this was obtained. There are two ways we have gotten these. First is we have quantum Monte Carlo studies. This is now determinantal quantum Monte Carlo. So this is exact. And this is on small systems. But these pictures that I showed you were inhomogeneous self-consistent Hartree-Fock calculations. And on small systems, the two calculations agree, but these inhomogeneous calculations allow us to do really big systems, so we can do the scaling. That's the point, yeah.
I mean, this is what you're reporting is something remarkable.
Thank you. Thank you. It's even published. I even managed to convince the referee, so it's published. It's a big feat for me. You know, for most things, we can't convince our referees.
Are there any other known examples where you have metallic clay sandwiches?
Part of my reason for talking here is I'm hoping that, you know, there are some expert experimentalists in the audience, and I'm hoping that they will be able to look for this, you know, or similar effects,
so
and so on.
We don't know it's the matter.
I've talked to Satoru Nakatsuji in Japan, and he says he is going to send me data where they see this, but I haven't seen the data yet. So I think it's generating some discussion, but I haven't seen any proof yet.
One last, at least one I guess. So is there a way of maybe addressing, not only your participation rate, but is there a way to address the record?
Yes, we have looked at the conductivity also. I've just run out of time today, but we have looked at the conductivity. In fact, you know, inverse participation ratio is not a good measure. It's a very nice visual measure, but we have looked at the current-current correlation function, and it has a very different omega dependence. So in the MOT phase, there's a clear gap. Okay, this is the imaginary part of the current-current correlation function. In the metallic phase, it is actually linear. And in the Anderson, or this gapless insulating phase, it goes like omega cubed. So this quantity divided by omega gives you, in the low frequency limit, gives you the conductivity.
And this is within the Hartree-Fock calculation?
This is within the Hartree-Fock calculation.
But of course, within Hartree-Fock, I think qualitatively the participation ratio tells you qualitatively what you want. No, so the thing is probably right.
Okay, let me, that is also a very important point, what Tomas is saying, that, you know, if this is a Hartree-Fock, you may still worry that it is effectively non-interacting and therefore it should look like the Gang of Four results. And we've done now, we've tried to sharpen that question a lot, And there we find that there are three major things that are making it different from Gang of Four. And those three are, firstly, here there are fluctuating magnetic fields. I didn't get a chance to say that in this Hartree fork, we not only have density fluctuations, but also field fluctuations. So the local field fluctuates. Then we also have the effective potential, which is generated, is a screened potential, which has long-range correlations. So it is not a short-range, uncorrelated disorder that you ultimately self-consistently generate. We put in completely uncorrelated disorder, but what we get out after we put the interactions is some kind of correlated disorder. And these are the two main things, which is why these are different, yeah.
I just want to ask a question of Takaki Sensei. At low doping, are the materials really insulators or not?
Yeah, I didn't get you, actually.
Well, if you go, let's say, to 5 or 4 or 3%, have people reached a low enough temperature where a lightly doped cuprin has a resistivity of infinity? Yes.
Yeah, but well, it's sort of an undoubted sure that.
Just one comment that these results are not relying on Hartree fork alone. Within DMFT for Hammer model plus disorder, you can also trace an intervening metastatic phase. The crucial question is really how to characterize the metastatic. What makes you say this is a metastatic machine?
So the way we characterize it is by the conductivity, the DC conductivity. If we look at the DC conductivity at zero temperature, it is finite in the metal and zero in the other two phases. As I said, we looked at the low frequency joint density of states. Well, the problem. Let me say in the DMFT, the problem in the DMFT is that, because it is effectively a single site problem, you don't get localization effects.
Let's see what happens.
No, that's not mine. Oh, yeah, it is mine. It is mine. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
I guess this title should be coexisting phases, and really, let's be honest here, coexisting antiferromagnetism. I thought one of the nice things about moving back to Canada, which I did a couple years ago, was that I'd only be applying to one funding agency. Clearly, that was not true. So there's a lot of, this work is motivated by a couple of different things. Mostly, it's motivated by the large experimental literature. It seems to show that as you move towards the underdoped side of the phase diagram, you have some kind of magnetic, static or quasi-static magnetic short-range order that pops up on the underdoped side of the phase diagram at low temperatures. And there's some experiments that suggest that this is kind of a glassy freezing that happens at low temperatures. There are some neutron scattering experiments that say that there are antiferromagnetic-like correlations. I'm making a distinction here now between the lanthanum-based cuprates, where there seems to be a lot of evidence that there are stripe-like correlations, and, for example, YBCO, where there's a lot of work which suggests that you might be having something glassy. And so the question that I set out to try to address is if this sort of quasi-static short-range order is occurring in these materials under the superconducting dome, what does it look like in an experiment? What kind of an effect does it have on your experiments?
Taking simplistically,
I'm doing a mean field calculation here. For various reasons, I was interested in doping inhomogeneously. This was before Seamus saw the oxygens, and we all believed that the main source of disorder was the Coulomb potential. It may still be the case in some of these materials, but maybe not in BISCO. So what I imagine is I've got some kind of kinetic energy term, then I've got some kind of Coulomb, screened Coulomb potential, which dopes the lattice. And then I have an interaction term, which I have to treat at a mean field level. So I keep a Hubbard term. I have to, if I'm going to have the Coulomb potential as my dopant to dope holes, then the electrons in the copper oxide layer also have to have a Coulomb interaction. And the combination of these leads to the formation of a screening cloud, which screens out my donor atoms. And then I just include this third term here, which is an exchange type of term. That just gives me superconductivity. So the mean fields I keep are a charge density, and it's a spin-resolved charge density, and then a pair density. And this is a singlet pair density. So I'm not considering the possibility of triplet contribution to the order parameter, although that's probably there. You can define then two useful order parameters. One's just a staggered magnetization, so it's just the local moment with this plus or minus one depending on where you are on the lattice. And you can define a hole density, which is just measured from half filling. And the only real value to doing that is that it just lines you up with the sort of the conventional language that's out there. Okay, so you can solve this on finite lattices, and this allows inhomogeneity in your solution to crop in. So these are different results. These are old results, these are new results, and they're slightly different scenarios here. The model's more or less the same. So this top left panel here, what I've done is I've taken a homogeneously doped sample, just do the simple problem first, and seed it with a random magnetization. So on every site, I just put in a random moment, and then allow it to relax. So I do some kind of iterative scheme. It's a little bit tricky because the iterations won't converge by themselves, so you have to use some kind of accelerated iteration scheme. And you find, what is the solution, the low energy solution, the local minimum of your potential landscape that it finds. And you try this for a bunch of different random initial configurations, say 50 or something like that, and you keep the lowest energy one, or maybe you just compare the lowest few energy ones. And what you see is that although every solution is different, certain correlations crop up again and again and again. And so what you get here is something that looks very checkerboard-like. This is the staggered magnetization, and so it goes from up to down as I move across here. It's not a perfect checkerboard, and I think that's just a frustration that arises because there's an incommensurability between my superlattice here, my 40-site superlattice, and the periodicity of the spin density wave. And you can Fourier transform it. What you find is you get this donut in Q space. Now, actually, this is not the staggered magnetization. This is the actual magnetization, so it's centered on the antiferromagnetic wave vector. But you get this donut of wave vectors that are appearing in this this static magnetic pattern. And this donut is bounded by these nesting vectors here. So you're almost antiferromagnet, but in fact, in the superconducting phase, what seems to be preferable is nesting at the antinodal points. Now, I have to take a step back here and mention, when I say antiferromagnet, I'm being a little careless. These are spin density waves. They are metallic states. They're not insulating states. I have a TT prime model, which means my Fermi surface has got a lot of curvature in it, and that means that unless I make U very large, I don't gap out the Fermi surface. So that means I still have a fairly large piece of Fermi surface which can go superconducting, and that means that my antiferromagnetism and my superconductivity actually coexist spatially everywhere in this picker. I'm only showing the magnetization here, but over there I'll show the superconductivity. So they coexist spatially. But they do compete in the sense that where the antiferromagnetism is big, the superconductivity is small. So this is just now I dope inhomogeneously. Same doping, pretty much. These are both doping levels which lie close to the border between the magnetic and the non-magnetic solutions. And what you see is the correlations are less obvious here. You have regions where, by accident of the way the thing is doped, you wind up with relatively large magnetization. And elsewhere, you find that the magnetization is maybe a bit smaller. I'll say more about that in a second on this side here. And you find that you get roughly the same Q vectors involved, except that things kind of smear out. But the width of this pattern is not determined by the correlation length of my magnetization. It's determined, it's bounded by these Q vectors here. It's the width of this donut, the broadening of this donut into kind of a central peak. That
the donut results because of this over-averaging, or is it for individual configuration?
This donut is this configuration.
So you have, for this individual configuration, you have a continuum of low energy states.
Continuum of low energy states.
Well, you don't have a break peak at 1 peak, like in that.
No, I have a bunch of, I mean, there's a red dot here, so it means I'm getting a large contribution from that particular Q. Well, in a sort of a random-ish kind of way, right? Different configurations will give me different red dots and different yellow dots, but they're always going to lie on this kind of a donut. Okay, if I tune my doping just right so that the periodicity is commensurate to the lattice, I can get a nice spin density wave where the donut collapses into a few, I mean, really collapses into these points here. I'm not so keen on doing that because, of course, the real systems are going to have disorder. And what we see with the disorder, this is a very robust result. So whereas this depends a lot on how I set the calculation up, this result doesn't. Once the disorder there becomes quite robust.
So in the stripe physics, the reason that one doesn't have a pi-pi sharp spot is because there are these phase shifts.
Yeah, there are different ways of looking at it. One way is to say what I've got is an anti-Fermi magnet with a bunch of domain walls. Another way to say it is I've got a spin density wave that's got a Q which is not quite the anti-Fermi magnetic Q. Okay, so if I look at this picture here, this is the three panels, top to bottom, are charge density, magnetic staggered magnetization, and superconducting gap, the D-wave gap. And this is for a particular configuration, this is for a different configuration, this is for a different configuration. So what I do is I put my donor atoms a lattice constant a half above the copper oxide layer. They've got a charge of -2. I calculate this, you know, this is the self-consistent calculation for the charge density, the self-consistent magnetization. You notice here, for this calculation, I've seeded it differently. I haven't seeded with a random moment, and what I get then is really something more like what you're describing, which is I've got a region of antiferromagnet, I've got a domain wall here, which is this black curve, and then I've got a region of antiferromagnet, but with the opposite sign. And, well, actually, sorry, this is the gap, and this is the moment. I've got them backwards here. What's interesting, I think what I want people to take away from this picture here is that the domain walls in these calculations always pin themselves to the charge donors. So this seems to be a very robust result. If you can see, there's a black line that traces, kind of does it connect the dots. If I seed it slightly differently every time, I'm going to get a different, obviously, I mean, there are lots and lots of different ways that the domain walls can pin themselves to these charge donors, but they do this robustly. This happens every time I do this calculation. Okay, so now density of states. The first thing that I looked at, I was very inspired by Seamus's experiments, I guess as many of us are. The green curve here, which nobody can ever see, is the D-wave one, which is okay, you can imagine it, you don't have to see it. The red one here is my magnetic. This is if you have a nested antiferromagnet, but not the nested Fermi surface. You have this nice four-band model. And then what you have here, if I turn the superconductivity off and I make the magnetization a little bit bigger, what I have is I have a nice finite residual density of states at the Fermi surface. And if a gap does open, if I actually make the magnetization large enough that a gap opens, it's not going to open at the Fermi level first, and that's because I don't have a symmetric band structure. So the magnetic energy scale in this, by the way, is just the Hubbard U times the staggered magnetization. And so that's the other energy scale other than delta, which is important in these calculations. What you see is that if I compare the green curve, which is superconductivity, with the black curve, which is the coexisting phase, I have two things. I have, first of all, something which is, well, three features. One, the nodal points aren't really affected. I don't think that's a big surprise. Something is happening out at the antinodal points, maybe also not a big surprise. And then I have a suppression of spectral weight, which is on some energy scale, occurs over some energy scale, which is related to M. Okay, so those are the three sort of generic features of this. This is for the three different particular configurations of disorder, and the thing that separates them is that they have three different average staggered magnetizations. If you want to turn this into an energy scale, multiply by 3.2. And so the black here is the one with the smallest, the weakest magnetic correlations, and I have nice sharp coherence peaks. By the time, and again, this figure haunts me because these two are reversed. The red is the highest magnetization of 0.11, and the green, every time you think you've deleted all the files which have the incorrect legend, another one pops up somewhere. So the red has the largest magnetization, and what you see is that the coherence peaks have been wiped out, and that the nodal, but the nodal states are more or less intact, and there's some shift of spectral weight up to higher energies. Okay. So the question that I wanted to answer is, there's been a lot of talk about the possibility of competing phases. The problem with competing phases from STM point of view is that most of them are not particle hole symmetric. And so if you're going to do a tunneling experiment, how do you avoid this problem that the tunneling spectrum is particle hole symmetric and yet most competing phases, like antiferromagnetism or these you know, these orbital current phases, they are tied to the lattice and therefore they're not particle hole symmetric. So the question is, if you have one of these phases coexisting with superconductivity, could that be consistent with the kind of spectrum that Seamus measures? And so what I've done here is I've taken a single pocket that's got some radius, and by changing the doping inside that pocket, I can induce magnetization, and then by the time you get outside the pocket, you just have your pure D-wave superconductor again, and the red curve here is at the center of the pocket, and the black curve indicates the site at which the magnetization's followed to half its value. So it's roughly the boundary of the pocket. And then what I do is I can embed this in an infinite system and I can calculate the spectrum and I don't have to worry about finite size effects when I do it this way. The green diamonds here are the local value of delta. So what you see is that these coherence peaks actually just track for small values of m here, and this is an energy which is comparable to the slightly less than the gap energy, you can see that the coherence peaks really just track the local value of delta rather nicely. And the spectrum is pretty symmetric. You start to build up a little bit of a shoulder down there, but for the most part, it's pretty symmetric. And so the takeaway message is that so long as this energy of the magnetic, the antiferromagnetic phase, is not too much bigger than delta, the symmetric quasi-particle spectrum more or less survives intact. Once you get to be much larger than delta, then all bets are off. You start to develop localized resonances. So you can see I'm developing a localized resonance here, which is at the core. I've got another one out here, which is up at higher energy. You start to develop a lot of structure. The spectrum here looks nothing like the spectrum of an antiferromagnet, looks nothing like the spectrum of a superconductor. Scattering at the interface between these two regions is really important. And then again, when I get out here, the most prominent features in the spectrum don't even track the local value of the gap anymore. Yeah?
So for these M values, do any of them open a gap? I mean, you have some cheap...
Yeah, by the time I'm getting up to this... Now, I don't know why I have... I don't even remember what this figure is anymore. But I know. This is one I kludged by hand. This is a self-consistent calculation. This is not. This is a sharp boundary between the two regions. Okay. What you're doing is, in this one here, you're opening up a gap. The energy is about right that you're starting to open up a gap. And when you do open up a gap, it opens up at the coherence peak. And so this is the mechanism by which you wipe out the coherence peak in this model, is that you're opening up a gap at the antinodal point, on top of the superconducting gap, which is already open there. So this gives you some mechanism for wiping out the coherence peak, is that you're not leaving the nodal part undisturbed. Down here, even here, although the peak is sharpening, you're still stealing spectral weight from it. So there's a lot less spectral weight under this peak than there is under that peak. Okay, I'll come to that point. This is different calculation. So rather than having a single antiferromagnetic disk embedded in an infinite system, you can do the same thing. You take a self-consistent calculation. This is a 30 by 30 lattice. And you can look at a region. This is the hole density. So this is high hole density. This is a region which is going to be a good superconductor. And this is going to be a region where you've got strong antiferromagnetism. And you can look at the local spectrum at each point. And in order to get good spectral resolution, you average over a large number of boundary conditions. So this is the density of states in the superconducting region. I've got nice giant coherence peaks there, and that's partly because there is a Van Hoff singularity folded in there. Then I move into this other region, which is doped differently. The Van Hoff singularity has been moved off to the side there. But what you really notice is I've got these very, very sharp peaks here. And you might say, well, that's an artifact of this particular disorder configuration. But in fact, it seems to be a very robust feature. However, the weight under this feature is pretty small. And if I throw in some kind of, you know, scattering rate's not small. This is all quasi-particles, but in reality, scattering rate's not small. And by the time you get out to the gap edge, the scattering rate's fairly large. And what you see is that there's so little spectral weight under here that this scattering, if I convolute the spectrum with a self-energy, the scattering rate just wipes the peak out, whereas the coherence peaks survive quite nicely. So I guess what I'm trying to, the take-home message from that is that these kinds of anti-ferromagnetic correlations, I mean, I'm doing static correlations here, but I don't know that they have to be static, are by opening up a gap in the spectrum at the antinodal points. That is a mechanism for wiping out the antinodal, the coherence peaks. Now, the last thing I want to talk about, I don't know what I've got, 2 minutes, half an hour, something like that. Somewhere between 2 minutes and half an hour. I've only got two slides left. So penetration depth, this is the most recent part of this. This is really a nice low energy probe, and there have been some work by the UBC group where they look at how the penetration depth evolves as you approach the around oxygen 6.35, where you are at the edge of the superconducting dome. And they can tune the whole concentration by basically applying hydrostatic pressure, and they see quite a pronounced evolution in the superfluid density. So the question is, what do you get if you have antiferromagnetic correlations? How does that affect the superfluid density? And I'll just remind people here, you have a diamagnetic part, which basically counts electrons in your system divided by effective mass. And then you have a paramagnetic part, and that's the part that's supposed to have all the temperature dependence in it. The paramagnetic part, so this is your kernel that relates the current to the applied field. And when the paramagnetic part cancels the diamagnetic part, which happens at TC, you find that there's no current in response to an applied vector potential. So above TC, these two terms have to cancel. And at T equals zero, in a conventional superconductor, this term here vanishes. This term basically counts quasi-particle excitations, which happen thermally. And all you've got left is this, and this is just saying all my electrons are somehow screening the applied field, and the penetration depth is just related. 1/1 the penetration depth squared is just related to this thing here at T equals zero. So now the question is, if you're going to reduce the superfluid density at T equals zero, how can you do it? Well, one way we know how to do this in D-wave superconductors is you add dirt, and what the dirt does is it gives you a finite residual density of states, means that there's a finite density of states at the Fermi level here, and that means that this paramagnetic term doesn't vanish at T equals zero. Because, so there are two things that cause this paramagnetic term to vanish at T equals zero. One of them is the fact that there's a gap in the spectrum, and this thing basically counts low energy excitations, and so there are none at T equals zero. But so the residual density of states here is directly tied to the fact that the superfluid density is suppressed as a result of that dirt. But the signature of this plateau in the density of states is the fact that you get a T squared behavior rather than a linear T behavior in the superfluid density. Okay, so last slide here. This is now as a function of this magnetic energy scale. This is the diamagnetic. This is my four-band model, so this is just my little kludged antiferromagnetic model. You find the diamagnetic contribution. The paramagnetic contribution at T equals zero is strongly temperature dependent on the magnetization, which makes this very different from a conventional superconductor because, as I said, this thing has to vanish in a conventional superconductor, which is this point here. So somehow, even though you still have a gap in the spectrum, I showed you the density of states, you're actually getting a finite paramagnetic contribution. Okay, you can calculate the temperature dependence. This is for the four-band model. I fix the gap delta, and this is just increasing the magnetic energy scale, and you see that the temperature-dependent superfluid density just scales down. The slope does change a little bit, But essentially, the important point in my mind is that you still have a linear temperature dependence here. The linearity of the temperature dependence comes from the fact that you have nice nodes, nice linear density of states. This is three particular configurations of disorder. So these are my finite size simulations. Same thing. This is small m, big magnetization, bigger magnetization. Still, the gap gets reduced by the average gap gets reduced. But the basic idea is still the same. You're getting a large suppression of the superfluid density. A little bit of curvature here, and that's not surprising given that the system is disordered. But the big thing is it's still pretty much linear, and there's this enormous suppression of superfluid density. These three configurations here correspond to these three cases here. So this is the same data sets. The nodal states are more or less intact. You can see for the most magnetized one, there's a little bit of residual density of states there, which is why you're getting some downward curvature. But basically, you have this nice linear behavior. Okay, so...
Is the slope doping dependent?
Is the slope doping dependent? I don't have... You mean the experiments? In this calculation? Well, I don't really have doping in here. What I have is this parameter M, which is magnetic correlations. And so...
the whole concentration for the system, you don't have?
The whole concentration for the system does vary between these, and I guess I'm assuming that the magnetization does vary with the whole concentration, but that relationship is not going to, so yes, the slope is going to be slightly doping dependent in these calculations, but it's not going to be dramatically doping dependent. Okay.
This is a slightly different type of calculation than the one you showed us earlier, where you put the holes in by hand.
This is dope. This one here, I've got my out-of-plane donors. So this is my four-band model here. This one here, I've got my out-of-plane donors. I do the self-consistent BDG calculations, calculate the superfluid density.
Yeah, my question is how is this slope depend on the number?
Well, okay, so this is a more underdoped and this is a more overdoped. And so now, if you want a quantitative relationship, I wouldn't trust these calculations. These are very simple calculations here, right? So they show trends, but quantitative statements are very hard to come by here. I find it, from my perspective, the relationship between the doping and the magnetization is not going to be correct for this. This is mean field, Bogloboff, DeGen. We know that in Hartree-Fock, you tend to very much overestimate the amount of magnetization. The susceptibility is probably a stronger function of magnetization than you would get out of these kinds of calculations. Sorry, the susceptibility is probably a stronger function of doping than you'd get out of these kinds of calculations. So as far as a quantitative statement about how the magnetization varies with doping, I wouldn't trust these calculations. What I would say these calculations tell you is they tell you that this is a mechanism. Having growing antiferromagnetic correlations is a mechanism to reduce the superfluid density substantially while leaving a linear temperature dependence in the superfluid density. So the last point I want to make about this is, there's a sum rule here, so the superfluid density is being replaced, is being reduced. All that spectral weight's got to show up somewhere. So where does that spectral weight show up? The answer is it shows up at a large energy scale, which is delta squared plus m squared. And this is just what I'm showing here is the real part of the optical conductivity as a function of frequency scaled by delta squared plus m squared. So, yeah?
The note was right on that figure C, it's red and green.
Have I gone backwards again? Let's see. The numbers are definitely right on this one, but I probably got the colors reversed from the other figure. And I thank you for pointing that out, actually, because now I've got to go and change this figure, too. 0.24, so I'm increasing M. So this is 0.35, 0.24, 0.13.
You're saying that it's the M change that's important.
Yeah.
Delta also changes, but that's...
Well, delta does change, that's right. And what I've done is I've scaled the temperature scale by delta because what you expect delta to do is to change the slope, right? Delta determines V2, which determines the slope of your temperature dependence. And so what I've done is the scaling here. So there is an additional slope change beyond just what you would expect from the change in delta. And that this is I'm basically done here. I don't have a conclusion slide.
Two things that we can think of in 28 minutes.
It is the leading contender.
Did I get distracted in the regions where you have magnetic water? There is a local concentration which is off half billion.
Yeah. So,
in those regions where n is finite,
yeah.
The open is not necessarily half, or you're
not. Oh, that's right. Yes. Okay. So this is the point. I'm not. I can't describe the half-filled case at all because.
So that's a question that I'm having to ask. So if these regions are off half-filling,
yeah.
And the calculation is done with the Hartree Fock, I thought that the purely anti-ferromagnetic solution would be unstable against spiraling. So,
unstable against spiraling.
Order parameter is not the lowest mean field order parameter that you get in Hartree Fock. So, whenever you relax on those magnetic islands, on those anti-ferromagnetic islands.
Okay, these are not anti-ferromagnets per se. Yeah.
The direction of the spin.
So, it's not clear to me. I have two answers to this. So first of all, is this the lowest energy solution? I don't know.
On the level of
Hartree Fock, I don't know. These things are very complicated. But maybe I don't care because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to reproduce what's seen in the experiments. And so I take a phenomenological view here that I'm trying to look for solutions that reproduce what's seen in experiments. But that doesn't say that it wouldn't be interesting if there were other lower energy solutions.
What he's saying is that if you allow your magnetization to come next to your agreement.
Oh, you mean canting out of... Yeah, well, so the other part answer to this is that, and this is just off the top of my head, is that superconductivity tends to quantize, pick a spin direction, right? And so that if you're going to cant a moment, then you're also going to have to do something to your pairing. And so I wonder if the pairing might stiffen, the superconductivity might stiffen.
The question is more to, for example, you put pictures like the static correlation function, so just a Q, those obviously would be influenced by having an additional spiraling of the magnetic field.
Yeah.
So if you get these cone-shaped things, they would obviously also change once there's a spiral angle.
There are a couple. I guess if I were to reinterpret, you're saying let's relax another degree of freedom. There are other degrees of freedom that should be relaxed as well. I should, for example, I should really be including triplet contribution here, because the anti-ferromagnetism induces a triplet contribution. The question is always how much. And that's why I haven't included it, because I'm trying to keep things simple. And then there's always then the question about whether you get spontaneous currents generated. That's another degree of freedom that needs to be relaxed. But your point is well taken. It's a good point.
There must be some nearly anomalous calculations floating around on vortices. Do you know about that literature, Mike? And people get the right answer from?
You're talking about the vortex core. I mean, the one I'm most familiar with is the Catherine Callan, Daniel Knapp calculations. I'm not sure what the right.
Well, they see a standard.
The charge modulation issue is kind of I don't see a lot of charge modulation here arising from the order, and I don't think that they see a ton of it. Anybody do remember the answer to that?
I don't know, but I think my sort of wild guess is that since most calculations came after the
experiment,
that they've done.
Yeah.
But it's actually, then the vortices, the phase is actually very important. Low energy really is the phase difference. Generates a lot of the peaks inside the gaps and so on. So the results are going to be quite different.
But I was just saying on this, do we have an example of a similar model which produces something that we can't trust? Are we floundering in parameter space and in model space? It's a very reasonable thing to try to do, but I don't know what the criteria is to decide whether it's successful or not.
I'm not sure how you define success. So you want to know how I define success? You mean like tenure or something like that? No, I think so I guess I am floundering, yeah. So to be blunt about this, I'm doing something like a random walk through phase space. I'm looking for what are the interesting questions that one can ask about this, and what do you expect given that these correlations seem to be here. As far as pre-existing literature, there's a little bit of literature that I've just discovered on the ternary superconductors, but I haven't done an extensive literature search. There is the stuff on the vortices, but I haven't found anything that's directly relevant to what we're doing here or what I'm doing here.
So something which would be very helpful to the tunneling experimentalists, I've said this to Bill many times, and I'm saying this because I think studying coexisting antiferromagnetic correlations and superconductivity could be of great relevance to what we're trying to do.
Yep.
If we knew which element of the spectrum represents the antiferromagnet.
Yeah. I think I'm still at the stage of where it's something of a random walk, right? I'm not sure I can...
I measure some density of states as a function of energy. I want to know which feature in that complicated curve tells me the magnitude of the antiferromagnetic artifact. That would be tremendously valuable.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's thank the other
watching all these talks, was that Mark Twain who said something about Ohio or Cincinnati that if the world came to an end, you'd want to be in Cincinnati because everything happens 20 years later there? I think he said something like that. So, when I first applied to attend this workshop, I was completely intending this blue thing go away.
I have no idea how to turn it off. I'm
trying to feel things. There you go. That's not quite right. You push one button too many.
I think it just doesn't come along with the color light.
Well, I'll turn it off. It's just a bit hardwired.
Oh, there's a switch to the screen there. The middle one.
Not.
Farther left.
And the middle one only does
the
screen.
Middle. Oh, we get two screens. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Okay. Okay. When I... Okay. Thank you. Well, I'm hungry, so I'm going to take as little time as I can. When I first applied to attend this workshop, I was planning to talk about impurity effects in the TJ model. In other words, putting in the strong correlations, which is apparently a fairly difficult thing to do. However, at the roughly the end of April, my attention was hijacked by finally figuring out something. And as a consequence, I've spent most of the last couple months thinking about this instead of impurities. So this is what I will talk about. Namely, I think I have found a strong superconducting correlation length for dx squared minus y squared pairing in the TJ model. This is work that was done in collaboration with Marco Lucchini, who at the time we started this project was still at Imperial, but has since moved on to much greener pastures as a computer consultant. He has made a lot of money that way. Okay. There's nothing exotic here. Standard TJ model, projected hopping term, nearest neighbors only, spin-spin interaction, again, just nearest neighbors. And I'm only going to look at spin singlets. I'm not going to look at triplet pairing, so only singlet pairing. And the I and J's here for these pairing operators, I'm not going to restrict to nearest neighbors. I'm going to let them be whatever they want to be. Okay. The correlator that we have calculated is this quantity. This is just the four-point correlator. And all this other mess that's below it is subtracting off the single particle contributions to the four-point correlator. Okay? These are terms that, strictly speaking, can't tell you anything about pairing correlation, because they're not related to the interactions at all. Now, the type of calculation I do is a high-temperature series expansion. This is a linked cluster expansion. So what I do is I calculate this quantity on clusters, and then add up all the results to produce a series. These sites, I, J, K, and L, are sites on the clusters at this point. They're not identified yet with sites on the infinite lattice. Okay, the clusters, in some sense, when you calculate things, are free-floating, and it's not until you identify them by embedding them into the infinite lattice that you know exactly how these sites are related to each other. Okay, so I generate all this data by doing the series expansion. This requires roughly the generation of 500,000 pieces of separate data. The problem is that you have the four-point correlators, you have these two-point correlators, you have the free energy that you need to do an expansion for. And also, if I and L are equal to each other, or J and K are equal to each other, that's a separate correlator also. That's just the local charge density. There is one restriction on these sites from the TJ model, and that is simply that I and J can't equal to each other, and K and L can't be equal to each other. In other words, I can't put a pair on a single site. That's all that that's saying. Okay. So once I've generated all these correlators, I now embed them into the infinite lattice, and I calculate these guys. These have in them internal coordinates of the pairs, r and little r prime, and they have a coordinate which gives the distance between the centers of masses of the pairs. Okay, that will be the coordinate that I'm really interested in, because that will tell me about how these pairs are correlated. You notice in this quantity I haven't said anything yet about symmetry, because I haven't put any symmetry in yet. That's the next step. The types of pairs I'm going to look at are, well, S-wave, where the symmetry is all the same, and two D-wave pairs, dx squared minus y squared, obviously, and dxy. Where, now this is the symmetry for a single pair. And what you have to imagine is putting one operator here at the origin, then another operator on a site somewhere else. And wherever that second operator is, picks up the relevant phase from that part of the lattice. These black lines are nodes, where if you tried to put an operator there, the symmetry strictly says that that is zero. Okay? So what I then have are two phases, which I just call phi sub I. The I is labeling the type of symmetry I'm considering. And in general, these phases can be plus one, zero, or minus one for these three types of pairing I'm considering. Now, from the real space correlators and these two phases, I want to construct a correlation function which depends upon the separation of the pairs and their symmetry. And this is where things got difficult, and you might not think that would be so hard, but it slowed me down for quite a while. The first choice is simply to sum over R and R prime. And this is what stumped me for a long time. This is more or less what has been done in the literature. The difference between what is done in literature and what I'm doing in this type of calculation is that in the literature, people have typically restricted themselves to nearest neighbors for R and R prime. Okay, so they've limited those things to nearest neighbors. I was letting R and R prime be more extended than that, but otherwise it was basically the same idea. What I found when I did this is that the resulting correlators I was finding in the real space and function of capital R, when capital R was not zero, these correlators tended to be very, very tiny and negative. And if you think about that for a second, that makes absolutely no physical sense. I mean, it's saying that instead of having a maximum at Q equals zero, you have a minimum. And that doesn't make any sense in this sort of calculation. And that stumped me for a long time. And
Would that be caused by the temperature? Maybe it's not well converged to low temperature?
No, it's basically negative at high temperatures and just stays negative all the way down. And very tiny, yes, I should say.
Wouldn't you want the extension of your chaos? I guess that's what the little r is measuring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you want that to be small compared to distance? If you restrict your sign to this, shouldn't this work?
Well, what I would prefer is that the model tells me how big the pairs are. So I don't really want to put any restrictions on the little r's. I want the basically just calculate all contributions I get, and what will come out naturally is that as little r's get bigger and bigger, they don't get very big, the contributions fall off very quickly in size. Okay? I mean, if you go out more than just a few lattice spacings, at very most, these things become very tiny. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's essentially the problem, yeah. Now, this seems like a simple problem, but it took me a long time to figure out this one way to get around this. The way to get around this is to essentially move your pairs apart and not change the internal orientation of things. Okay, so if I have a pair oriented like this, the other pair is oriented like this. If I orient this one like this, I have to orient this one like this. And since I'm not, in this calculation anyways, interested in how I orient these pairs, I then will sum over the orientations of one pair, like that. Okay? That's essentially the correlator that I have. Now, you might think I've thrown out the problem here by doing this, because now the phase comes in as a square. This is really a square now of the phase. But remember, the phase has nodes. The nodes will still be present in the square of the phase. I just simply won't have this plus or minus problem, which can give kind of an artificial cancellation. A caveat to this, though, is that we really do need to consider little r bigger than 1 now in order to distinguish, say, S wave and dx squared minus y squared pairing. You really do need to let little r be bigger. Because if you restricted yourself to